Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. It's episode number 631. My name is Camden Busey. I'm recording from Grays Lake, Illinois at Reformed Forum. And I'm, of course, happy and delighted to be back with you today to talk about the issues in Reformed theology, and we have a great episode lined up. First, let me introduce to you one of our colleagues, a member of our board. We have Jim Cassidy, who serves as the pastor of South Austin OPC in South Austin, Texas. Hey, Jim, how are you doing?
Doing great, Camden. How are you?
I'm well. It's good to see you. And excited about all the episodes we have recently had come out and the several that are scheduled and coming out today and on into the coming weeks. And one of those that I've been looking forward to for quite some time is with our guest today, a general editor of a very significant and important series. We welcome to the program Dr. Jordan Baller, who serves as a senior research fellow at the Acton Institute. Welcome, Jordan. It's great to see you and great to meet you.
Yeah, same here. Thanks, Camden and James. It's great to be here with you. Thanks for having me.
We really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us. And listeners should be excited because Jordan, of course, is one of the general editors for Abraham Kuyper's Collected Works in Public Theology. So some people have been seeing these. Sometimes they're on my shelf. Or at least visible on the camera. There's a whole range of these, if I'm not mistaken, 12, maybe 14 volumes. I don't even know the total number, but there's a lot of them in there. This is a small one. Our program is maybe my favorite so far, but it's a small little one compared to some of the others. You can see, you brothers won't see this because I've got another camera angle, but we've got Common Grace Volume 1. I've got On the Church off camera on the side, and Common Grace is just one of two volumes. So there's a lot to talk about. And of course, these are all available. Yep, there we go. These are all available digitally as well. You can get them through Lexham in the Logos software, which I use every single day, even for my daily Bible reading. And so feeding these on to there is just another helpful, very convenient way to get large amount of theology. And when you're going on holiday breaks, as many of you probably just got back from not too long ago, you know, carrying six of these around is inconvenient. But if you have a tablet or your phone, your laptop, you could have your entire library with you and read to your heart's content and search around. So today we're going to be speaking about the theology of Abraham Kuyper and in general, but more specifically, these collected works in public theology and about the project they're in to translate them and bring them into this new series and new edition that we have in English. But before that, we've got a couple announcements and things to mention. So, Jim, I'll hand things over to you.
Yeah, thanks, Camden. Just real quick, very briefly, want to make a promotion for what we're doing in South Austin, Texas. We have been blessed with the opportunity to purchase a new church building to establish ourselves here in South Austin. Many of you know and have been praying for us, especially since we have been removed from our previous meeting facility, which basically, to give the long and short of it, was deemed to be too much religion in a public sphere. So our hosts at that time had come up with new rules and laws that prevented us from being able to continue meeting at that place. And so we were praying in earnest as a congregation for the Lord to provide a place that we could purchase, call our own, so that we can set up regular outreach and worship ministries at that particular facility. The Lord has provided that, but we need some help in order to offset the debt that we would incur, which would be extreme at this point, given the high cost of real estate here in Austin. So the real estate market is going through the roof right now. It's out of control. So we are having to pay a premium in order to have the privilege of being able to set up regular ministries here in Austin. So just an appeal to our folks. We do have a webpage. If you go to southaustinpres.org/building, you will find there our landing page for donations. There's of course a mailing address if you'd prefer to send in a check or whatever, but we would appeal to those who are listening who really have a heart for the gospel and the Reformed faith to take root in a city that is not only dark, but seems to be every day getting increasingly darker. It's more than just a liberal city here in Texas. It's actually an increasingly paganized city where people who are looking for refuge to practice the dark arts, as it were, and all sorts of pagan religion are finding themselves here. I could go on and on about the increasing, not just secularization, but paganization of the city of Austin.
Keeping it weird.
Keeping it weird indeed. And we're becoming weirder and weirder as we go along, because as normal Christian folk, we're becoming the exception and not the rule here in Austin. So anyway, if you'd be interested in helping us, we would covet your help and certainly your prayers. And thank you for all the encouragement we have gotten from our listeners.
Well, thanks, Jim. We appreciate that. And we'll encourage people to visit the church online, find out more about the project. And I'm sure Jim would be willing to answer any questions. If you want to email him or contact him through the website, you certainly can do that and find out more information, ways you can help. So thanks so much. South Austin Prez down in South Austin, Texas. It's a real exciting time, but one in which they need some help. So you can step up to the plate and help on that front. Yeah, we've got a lot of things going on, a lot of events and other things going on this year. And if you'd like to stay in touch with us and keep up to date, you can visit our website at reformedforum.org. But I'd encourage people to subscribe to the email newsletter. That's an easy way to keep updated with what's going on. But our guest today certainly is known to many people, and he's a senior research fellow and director of publishing at the Acton Institute. But one thing, Jordan, as we get started here to talk more generally about the Acton Institute, I'd like our listeners to hear a little bit about what goes on there. But we recently did an episode with a friend of ours, Sean Rittenauer, who teaches economics at Grove City College. And we talked about the Christian principles of economics. But I see also that you've done some postdoctoral research in theology and economics at the Free University of Amsterdam. And often lecture and discuss on the subject of economics. So I'm curious, now that we've got two episodes kind of in short sequence on the subject, maybe people are starting to wonder if we're like forming some sort of governmental think tank. But it is significant and important to think about this. And I think that's an interesting entree for you to discuss your work in public theology and the connection of theology to other disciplines, and also the work of the Acton Institute more generally.
Yeah, so thanks for that. That's interesting to hear. We've had Sean lecture for us here at the Acton Institute before, and I know he sometimes talks about economics as a manifestation of common grace, so there's some other connections there.
Yes,
too.
Yes.
The Acton Institute was formed in 1990. It's based here in Grand Rapids in terms of its main offices, so we'll be celebrating our 30th year next year. And the core focus of the Acton Institute from the beginning is this integration between faith and economic life. It's ecumenical, so our founders were Roman Catholic, but there's been a variety of staff, leadership, and of other kinds from the beginning. Being based in West Michigan here, that functionally has meant Roman Catholicism and Aaron Piper.
Right.
I would say within the last 10 to 15 years, we've really focused more on other Protestant traditions too, more consciously reaching out and talking about faith and economics and work and the intersection of all these things from within the context of a variety of faith of religious traditions, but especially different Christian traditions and evangelical traditions. But from the beginning, Abraham Kuyper has been kind of a really important figure for the Acton Institute. Doctrines like sphere of sovereignty, especially understood as a kind of a principled form of limitation and definition of what government is for, and as a way of grounding public life for Christians, especially in the economics realm, but other realms as well, has really been an important figure in the development and thinking of the Acton Institute. Our main program that we run every year is called Acton University. It's a week-long conference that we have here in the middle to the end of June every summer in Grand Rapids.
Wow.
And that's been, you know, we've been doing that for a number of years now. We'll get anywhere between 800 and 1,000 people for that from all over the world. So we are based in Grand Rapids, but we have an office in Rome and in Argentina, so we do a lot of international work as well.
Wonderful.
One way of thinking about the Acton Institute was it was intended to fill a gap in this conversation between theology and economics. So in your seminary training, if it was anything like mine, you know, maybe you had one social ethics class, and maybe in that social ethics class you talked about economics for a week or something like that. I remember we read Ron Sider's Rich Christians in the Age of Hunger when I was at Dallas Seminary. But as pastors, I mean, you deal with money a lot, both in terms of running the church, but also in terms of trying to minister to the people in the pews and all the kinds of businesses and work that they're doing. So we started running essentially supplementary educational programs to try to reach out to people who are going to be religious leaders, who are thinking theologically and religiously about social ethics and economics, and trying to give them some grounding in the basic teachings of the Christian tradition, but also some grounding in economics, so we can people can start to bring these two together dynamically and peacefully.
Wonderful, wonderful. That's really exciting, and I always get interested in the connection between, you know, these core foundational theological principles, these doctrines that are contained within Scripture as God has revealed Himself unto us. You know, we got to understand that our theological study is not divorced from our practice in life, and economics is a huge part. And as the episode with Dr. Rittenour, hopefully, you know, displayed to many people who haven't thought of the discipline in this way, it's much more than just about, you know, tax rates. You know, we're talking really at the base level about human relationships, and to a degree, justice, or what is right in terms of how superiors and inferiors relate to one another, and how a society might be structured and governed. And so it's much more than just finance. It includes finance, but it's about human relationships and the structures for engaging in exchange. And so on that front, I mean, it's a very significant topic, and the Bible has a lot to say about the study of economics. It's not an economics textbook or a manual. Nevertheless, the Bible and our theological reflection upon Scripture has a lot of implications for economics study. And so I'm curious, as you mentioned, the Acton Institute and its kind of broader focus, international focus, but also ecumenical focus, how have people responded to the theology and the ideas of Abraham Kuyper? He's a very public man. When he was alive, he'd been kind of a polymath at that. But nevertheless, I mean, his doctrines are, you know, explicitly reformed at root. Have people received them generally? Do they, if they're not coming from reformed presuppositions or reformed position, have they found him to be, you know, eccentric and odd?
Yeah, I would say one of the reasons Kuyper has been such a formative figure in the Acton Institute's history, as well as my own thinking, is, you know, when you're just kind of taking stock of the different Christian traditions and the way they've worked out the kind of integration we're talking about, what we might call public theology, or at least social teaching. You've got certainly a paradigmatic example of Roman Catholic social teaching, kind of inaugurated in its modern understanding in 1891 with Rerum Novarum, Pope Leo XIII's encyclical. And if you kind of think, well, what other Protestant traditions are there that have that legacy of a kind of sustained and principled and really deep reflection on this integration between the Christian faith and its public expression? You can think of other examples, certainly. Most of them tend to be individual figures. We don't have a magisterium in Protestantism in the same way that Roman Catholics do.
Not even the Gospel Coalition?
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, you know, yeah, certainly parachurch kind of organizations, but also other kinds of ministries do tend to fill in the gap in a way, in a less formal way.
Sure, but, I mean, sure. I kid, but yeah.
People are going to have to deal with these kinds of questions, and they need resources and authorities and wisdom to draw from. So there is a kind of informal, you know, you could kind of say teaching ministry that's been more or less codified in Protestantism. But I mean, the only real competitor, I think you could say in its modern expression, would be some kind of a reformed social teaching. And it's hard to think of somebody more fruitful and dynamic and comprehensive and inspiring, to be frank, than Abraham Kuyper.
Yes.
So you could cast it in terms of rivalry or co-belligerence or something like that. But I mean, certainly Roman Catholic social teaching and Dutch Neo-Calvinist social teaching are not identical. But they tread similar paths in the sense that they're both trying to work out of first principles, the worldviews that they're grounded in, and express those faithfully to address the contemporary challenges that we faced up in from 1891 to today, you could say.
Mm. So let's speak a bit about the works that are contained in this new series, the collected works in public theology, and about the project in general. You serve as one of the general editors. But clearly, I mean, there must be an enormous team involved to make something like this happen. Even just a single author, single contemporary book requires a great team to produce. But here we're speaking about translation. We're speaking about digitization, the editing space. Even just collating the materials can be challenging as well. Like, let us know how, you know, give us a peek behind the curtain here to understand all the work that's gone into this so we can appreciate it.
So the background, again, I mean, Kuiper and the Eck Institute have a long history, but specific to this project, one way of thinking about it is that it, in a very Kuiperian way, it developed organically and it grew. So originally the idea was that at Acton, you know, we want to talk about economics, but if you just talk about finance or economics or even stewardship, which was a really rich term, but if you talk about that without grounding it properly in a more broad understanding of the human person and relationships to God and society, then it's a really kind of a deficient understanding. So in this attempt to really, in a principled and comprehensive way, talk about economics from a broadly Christian, but specifically Protestant and even a Reformed perspective, we felt like more work needed to be done in terms of situating Protestant social teaching and cultural engagement and cultural discipleship and these sorts of things. So the original idea was to translate the volumes on Common Grace that Kuiper produced. This is one of the two main trilogies that Kuiper worked on in his life. The second volume is the largest volume in the entire 12-volume series, and I'm holding it up here.
Yes.
I was a little concerned how it would work logistically to produce this in the beautiful format that the publisher Lexham Press put together, but it works. So it's the largest book, but it is one coherent volume, the second volume. So that was the original idea, was we're going to do the three volumes on Common Grace. By historical accident, there were 10 chapters that Kuiper had originally intended to be, the concluding 10 chapters to volume 3. And those focus on Common Grace as addressed in the realms of science or scholarship, you could say, human learning, wisdom, and art. So these are the 10 chapters that are going to be kind of capstone to this three-volume series. They got left out accidentally the first printing of Common Grace when they originally appeared in the early 1900s. And were published separately. So we said, well, as a kind of a test run, we'll do these 10 chapters and put them out as a book because they're a nice, coherent, and really fine entryway into his thinking about Common Grace. And so that volume called Wisdom and Wonder, Common Grace and Science and Art appeared, I think, in 2011.
Yeah.
So that was the kind of really the background origin of the series. Well, once we got going on the larger Common Grace volumes, which together, I would guess are about 750,000 words, something like that, 700,000 words of translation.
Wow.
Those three volumes. We got connected more broadly with this international network of Kuiper scholars. We found out that there were other people working on translations. And so, eventually we developed a larger program, a larger project, which again took the name of the Abraham Kuiper Collected Works of Public Theology. That includes not just this Common Grace trilogy, but his second trilogy, Pro Rega, For the King, his more kind of later reflections on Christ's kingship and its implications for all of our lives. And so those two together are half of the series, those six volumes. And then we have kind of topical volumes in various areas for the remainder of the six volumes. So one of those, which you mentioned earlier, was Our Program. Which was a translation of his essentially commentary on the Anti-Revolutionary Party platform. And in this version we translated was in 1880. So that's kind of one on politics. We have one on education. We have one on the church. That was really important in terms of his ecclesiastical work and his thinking about ecclesiology. One on business and economics, as you might expect from the Acton Institute, one on charity and justice, which really deals more broadly with questions of social justice and social order, one on Islam as a kind of a paradigmatic case study of a principal theological engagement of another religious tradition. And so I think that gets us up to 12. Yeah. I may have I wasn't counting, but anyway, yeah. Those are the 12 volumes of the large series. And I'm guessing all told, it's somewhere between 2, maybe 2.5 million words in English translation. So it is really is a huge project.
It is enormous. It's hard to fathom just in terms of just the sheer magnitude of it. Like I said, I think I have 4 of the 12, and I eventually plan to get all of them. But I'm acquiring them much faster than I can read them, that's for sure. But it's fun, even just for me, with our program or Common Grace, I've dip in sometimes to a course that Dr. Mark Beach is teaching, an elective on Kuiper down at Mid-America Reform Seminary.
Yeah.
So kind of not quite halfway, but you know, between me and Chicago and you and Grand Rapids, you can pass on through Mid-America. And they've been a support as well to this program, along with many other institutions. But it's fun just to dip in even and to read some of these essays in our program, or you can find a Pro Rega, some of the others. You don't have to necessarily read them beginning to end, you know, volume 1 to volume 12, although you'd benefit from that. But Kuiper is so comprehensive, and it's as if he has thought about everything.
And just he has thoughts on everything. Yeah, and usually they're pretty reflective. Yeah, often they're worth reading anyway. He's not right about everything, obviously, but he does seem to have thoughts about everything.
Yeah. That's a better way to put it. Yeah. So yeah, it's clearly not everything in here is going to be buttoned up as much as we might like for, you know, a peer-reviewed journal or something like that.
It's a different genre, right? Richard Malthus talks about as a theologian on the run. And so one of the things that's attractive about him as a figure is not just his erudition, that he wrote all these things. And I mean, quite honestly, this selected collection of works is just a piece of what he wrote. I mean, I've got a bibliography here that Brill put out, and this is just a bibliography of Kuiper's writings.
Wow.
So, you know, and it's pretty comprehensive. You know, it's everything from letters to the more sustained reflections, but he wrote a ton. He wrote a lot, and he wrote a lot about everything, but he also lived it, right? So this is the other thing that's really interesting about him is he achieved a great deal in his, what you might call public life or his professional life as a newspaper editor. One of the reasons it's easy to dip into some of these larger works like Common Grace is because of their origins in his newspaper.
Precisely.
Right. The Common Grace volumes, for example, are the collections of series of essays that he wrote in his newspapers. And so then he was an entrepreneur too. So he would sell it to you in the newspaper form, and then he'd sell it to you again when he put it in the book form later.
Right.
But you can dip in and read one section, and that's like reading a weekly kind of essay. And it's part of a larger series, and you can certainly, you know, follow the whole series through its reasoning. But he does a good job of summarizing kind of what he had just talked about, digging some new territory, and then synthesizing and previewing what he's going to talk about next in the series of essays. So even though the book by itself, you know, looks really imposing and in some ways maybe inaccessible, the content really is accessible because it was designed for a lay readership, certainly in Common Grace's case, for example. And the same with Pro Rega, and to be read, and really for the edification of the broader church. So it's not, in all these cases, a really high-level academic audience, even though, I mean, he was such a dynamic and genius theologian that really rich.
Now, clearly, you know, some of these you just mentioned, essays and those things were written in 1880, so we're going on now 140 years.
Yeah.
And a lot has changed, you know, but even, you know, you've also written yourself on, and people obviously are interacting still with the work of Adam Smith in economics and, you know, from where we get the phrase, the invisible hand, and talking about markets and capitalism. So a lot has changed in specifics in terms of how our economic systems work. But nevertheless, I mean, many of these principles are the same. So I'm curious about your scholarship and the Acton Institute. How much translation, so to speak, not just has to occur with Kuiper's writings, but if you want to go a step further and not just, this isn't merely an interest of yours or the Acton Institute's of historical theology, is understanding what did Kuiper say for his context, but also there's a greater interest in learning and then applying things even to the present. So I'm curious, on a second level translation here, not just in the language, but also in the economic program or the theological program, how that might apply to a contemporary era.
Well, there's a great deal of work to be done. I mean, that's one of the that's one of the hopes of a project like this. A great deal of material is being put out in a relatively short amount of time, but we're taking the long view with this project. We're thinking of it as really as a kind of a first step of providing the primary source material so people can, if they want to, and I hope they would, go back and see what Kuiper himself says about things rather than just what we maybe have heard about Kuiper or what it's called Kuiperian or what passes for Kuiperian thought nowadays. Right. Go back and read the original source, engage with it, grapple with it, disagree with it, agree with it, be formed by it, be informed by it. But this really, again, then, is the first step to doing a more constructive and doing what Kuiper would have been was doing in his own time, which is applying these kinds of principled and eternal kinds of insights about theological insights about the human person, relationship to God and others, to our own contemporary situation. So yeah, the details in many, almost if not all, specifics are much different now, 100 plus years on, than they were in Kuiper's own time. Although many of the dynamics are similar. So the question, say, of pluralism now, yeah, the details of it look much different than it did in Kuiper's Netherlands at the end of the 19th or 20th century, although he had a challenge in his own time and place with respect to how do Reformed people get along with Roman Catholics, get along with progressives and more secular atheists and liberal types. How do all of these diverse groups of people, even within that context, fit together and live together in a way that's coherent and truthful for all of society? So yeah, we have a lot more in terms of the diversity that's confronting us now in a place like the United States, you could say, or even the Netherlands now, than 100 plus years ago. But many of the dynamics are similar. Many of the challenges are similar. So one of the things you can do is look for those principles, and Kuiper tended to articulate himself in terms of principles and then apply those. To identify the proper principles and then identify how those might be applied and translated, as you said, to our times today. And
wonderful.
We're convinced, obviously, that Kuiper has a lot to teach us, both positively, sometimes negatively. I mean, he made mistakes, and there are things you can learn that didn't work, or
maybe social issues, like in Common Grace, for example, that haven't aged well.
Right. I mean, he's certainly a man of his times, just like we all are. That's not. I mean, I don't mean that as an apology for him. He doesn't need anybody really to defend him. He did more. More than his share of writing is defending his own views as he did for himself. So, you know, the idea with this series really was to get back to Kuiper himself as best as we can, present him directly. So the intention here is to present the unabridged versions. I mean, you can imagine that there's going to be some work to take selections and make it more accessible even, but we're providing a full scholarly apparatus as we're able. We're not abridging things. We're leaving in references to specific figures that may or may not be of interest at all, unless you're really, focusing as a historical student on Kuiper's own context. But that's all in here. And so this is, again, the very first step, both in terms of translating Kuiper himself, but hopefully opening up a lot more in terms of research programs, but also practical programs, social thinking and practice today for people who can learn and be informed and inspired by Kuiper and that tradition.
Mm.
Jordan, we've been talking really kind of around the core issue, really, in the question of public theology.
Yeah.
I think we kind of get the sense as we've been talking what public theology might be. But it's kind of become somewhat of its own discipline in recent days, maybe even a cottage industry of sorts. Would you be willing to define for us what public theology is as a discipline most broadly, and then perhaps take us in more particularly to how it is that Abraham Kuiper should be understood as a public theologian?
Yeah, so my understanding is the term public theology, and even as a discipline, is, as you said, a much more recent development. So there are academic journals, like the International Journal of Public Theology, for example, that have arisen in the last couple of decades that are more formal outlets for academic theology, identified itself as academic study of public theology. something along those lines. So it's a phrase and it's a discipline that's been more recent in terms of its development. Historically, you could, or even genealogically, you could say it's related to the development of political theology in the 20th century. So there was an early 20th century development, formally of political theology, which, depending again how you define politics or the polis, could be very comprehensive or could be very narrow. My preference is for the term public theology, to think of that as a much more inclusive term, which would include something like political theology. But you could also say it might include something like economic theology or the theology of the family or theology of the body or something like that. So my definition, my working definition of public theology is a theology of and for public life, which could, you could define as social life or the life, the way that we live together in public. I think there's an even more particular Kuyperian kind of take on public theology that's worthwhile. And it's one of the reasons I think it's valid to apply this term, even though it's anachronistic. You know, Kuyper never referred to himself as a public theologian. He may be, as you look historically, a paradigmatic example of a public theologian, but that wasn't a term that was in use at the time. And when I think about public theology, and I'm going to introduce a couple of Kuyperian terms here, which we can talk a little bit more about. Traditionally, theology, if you think about it, in terms of its orientation, its institutionalization, has really been focused on the church as an institution. It's been focused on doctrines, true doctrines about God, true doctrines about Christ, true doctrines about the Holy Spirit, and the church itself, how it functions, how it ought to function, our understanding of the sacraments, confessional symbols, and things like that. Theological education has largely been focused, I would say historically, on what we might call the church as an institution, how it's supposed to work, what we're supposed to believe. I think of public theology as a kind of complement to that. So when I define public theology, certainly from within a kind of a Kuyperian context, I would define public theology as a theology of and for the organic church. So Kuyper has this institute-organism distinction when he talks about the ecclesiology. The church is an organism. The church is the body, you could say, the body of Christ throughout the world, not just, but including its institutional form, the forms that the institution takes in terms of sacraments and communal worship and things like that. Public theology is a theology of and for the church in this more broader, comprehensive sense of the church as a body, the church as, to use Herman Bobbank's imagery that he draws from the New Testament, the church as a leaven throughout all of society, throughout all of the world. And so that's that kind of a Kuyperian spin on a definition of public theology that I like to use more.
What is the, Jordan, just a follow-up, and that was very helpful, thank you. Follow-up to that, what is the role, we've been talking a lot about common grace and Kuyper's doctrine of common grace. What is the role of the antithesis in public theology? So Kuyper talked a lot about the antithesis, talked about the way in which, you know, basically worldviews clash when it comes to particularly public issues. You're going to have a distinctly Christian worldview clash against a non-Christian worldview. And even within Christianity, you're going to have, you know, certain clashes with regard to Catholicism and Reformed theology, just as two examples that you mentioned already. What is the role for Kuyper of the antithesis when it comes to engaging in public, you know, what we would now anachronistically call public theology?
So I think for Kuyper, you really have to hold common grace and the antithesis together. There are traditions which are inspired by Kuyper or figures who are inspired by Kuyper who are much more apt to emphasize the common grace part and not talk about the antithesis so much. And then there are traditions that you could say are much more heavy on the antithesis and not so much on the common grace. For Kuyper himself, those two things definitely have to go together and be held in balance and intention. So from the common grace kind of perspective, you can talk about all the commonality, all of the good gifts that continue to exist after the fall, all of the, in one way, it's a kind of an explanatory doctrine about why things aren't as bad as they could or should be, given what we believe about the comprehensiveness of the fall. Why is there still good out there? Why might we be able to observe something like civil good, even among people who don't profess Christ or are not regenerate? It serves that kind of an explanatory function But not just that, it also is a platform for other kinds of engagement and other kinds of developments. But the antithesis, as you rightly note, is a kind of a limitation on that. So it gives us some basis for some realistic norms about how far and how extensive this common grace or activism, you could say, Christian action on the basis of common grace might extend. So it's an explanation. It's an attempt to explain, as you noted, all of the different worldviews that are out there, which have just multiplied since Kuyper's own day, even though I think he identified many of the kind of key dynamics of modern secular and pagan worldviews. Just what the limits of cooperation or the limits of appropriation or engagement might be. Because there is a fundamental soteriological distinction between those that are part of the body of Christ and those that are not. So on the one hand, you've got an attempt to really do justice to the insights that can be gleaned, the truth that is out there in the sense of all truth being God's truth and having its source and origin in him, wherever it comes from, being normed and conditioned and limited by this really radical understanding of the way of life and the way of death, you could say. Going back all the way to Leviticus, that there's these two fundamental ways of being in the world. One right. is fallen and one is redeemed. Mm. And there is overlap. We remain human beings as redeemed human beings. So there's commonality there, but there's a difference in terms of, obviously, things as fundamental as our understanding of God, the understanding of the human person, obviously, is really important. One just quick illustration of this, Kuyper talks about the antithesis within the context of human learning, right? So this is where it may come up a lot, especially in kind of academic settings where you're trying to engage between theology and other modern disciplines like anthropology or sociology or economics. What are the shared points of departure or the shared assumptions and where do things differ? And Kuyper had a kind of a rule of thumb that the more you engaged a topic that had as its object, it's the object of discussion, spiritual realities, the greater divergence there's going to be. So there is a difference, obviously, in many ways between a Christian doing astronomy and a non-Christian doing astronomy in terms of mm-hmm. how to interpret the wonder that they experience and these sorts of things. A Christian doesn't necessarily adjust a microscope or a telescope differently.
Right.
Non-Christian scientists, but certainly within our frames of interpretation. And yet, you know, we measure things the same way. A Christian kilogram is the same as a non-Christian kilogram in that sense. But as we're dealing with human realities, and increasingly spiritual realities, there's going to be a corresponding greater divergence between our understanding of how all these things relate. So a materialist is, from a Christian perspective, going to have a hard time understanding something like sin. Not just a hard time, it's going to be impossible. It's going to be a category that doesn't make any sense, right? Whereas from a Christian perspective and a much more comprehensive and holistic view of the human person, his body and soul and spirit, you can have what certainly something like Kuyper and I would say as a theologian is a much more robust understanding of way of understanding the human person and all of those dynamics. So that's one example of how the antithesis kind of comes to concrete expression in Kuyper's thought is this principle of increasing differentiation as you deal with more spiritual realities. And certainly, once you get to theology proper, for example, you're not going to have really much
especially in the area of epistemology, that's going to come in, you know, quite significantly. So a follow-up question, just following this train of thought, looking again at Kuyper's Common Grace volumes, when Kuyper rolled out his set on Common Grace, it wasn't received non-controversially, right? Sure. I mean, there was a good deal of controversy that was generated not only in Kuyper's day and context, but there was sort of a hangover from his Common Grace volumes.
Down to today. I mean, it's got a legacy of controversy. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, right down the line. Would you be able, Jordan, just to maybe open that up for us a little bit? What is the nature of that controversy? You know, what is maybe the better way to set you up is what is Kuyper's distinctive contribution to the doctrine of common grace, and how was that controverted by his interpreters and disciples, et cetera?
Yeah. Kuiper was self-consciously doing a new thing in some sense with working with his work on Common Grace. So the way he describes it is that, arising out of the Reformation, many of the controversies of the day that took up the time and energies of reformers like Calvin and Bucer and Luther and Zwingli and others really were focused on what you might call questions of special grace. So they had to do with questions of soteriology and the church and the sacraments. Many of these things I've already mentioned. And Kuiper says that's entirely appropriate because that's where the greatest errors were. So that's where the attention needed to be focused. Theologians needed to focus their attention on these controversies because those were the things that were focused at that time. Those were the great fights of the day. As you get into the later generations of reformers in the post-Reformation period, Kuiper becomes more critical about the developments theologically. He once you get into the 17th century, on the one hand, he's very appreciative and certainly steeped in Reformed scholasticism and Reformed orthodoxy of the 17th century. At the same time, he thinks they continued to fight some of the same fights, and the disagreements and controversies became increasingly narrow, and even he might say focus on minutiae and splitting and dividing and arguing over things that maybe are important to get right, but maybe aren't the reasons that you should be living as a theologian day to day, or certainly forming new churches or having all these kinds of social consequences. So there's a kind of a critique for Kuiper about the direction of post-Reformation theology in that sense, that it stayed focused exclusively on what he would call special grace. And even though in a theologian like Calvin, very clearly there's an acknowledgement and appreciation for a confession of common grace, it doesn't get developed. And so this is his critique, basically, that there was a need for what, as I've already referred to, a theology of and for the organic church, the broader church, that just wasn't developed from Kuiper's perspective, sufficiently in the Reformation and post-Reformation period. So he thinks it's a lacuna in the history of Reformed dogmatics and theological development that he himself is going to address. And so that's why he spends so much time on it, because he thinks this is really where the key fight is, the key work needs to be done in his own day. The soteriological questions, not exclusively. I mean, he was controversial in a number of areas, including questions related to, the institutional church and special revelatory doctrines. But this is where he identified the key fight and why he spent so much energy on it, because he thought this was an underdeveloped aspect of Reformed teaching that really needed focus in the modern world. So you can imagine that's controversial for a number of reasons. It's controversial because it seems like it's not properly deferential or respected of the old Reformed fathers of the day. So Kuiper appreciated figures like Lucius, but he wasn't above criticizing when he thought they were wrong. And so in turn, when we read somebody like Kuiper, we should respect Kuiper and, just give him the same attitude. Right. And maybe he wasn't properly deferential or was or whatever. But I mean, it wasn't simply a rechristenation of Reformed Orthodoxy in the 19th century Netherlands that he was attempting to do. He was attempting to take this living faith and apply it responsibly in his own day. So from a kind of a traditional perspective, he's not sufficiently deferential or appreciative of the Reformed inheritance. He's too worldly. This is another concern. And certainly I think a legitimate danger of an overemphasis on common grace. We've already talked about a little bit in the context of this discussion on the antithesis. You can get a kind of a common grace Kuiperianism that really doesn't talk much about the antithesis or is really... I think optimistic about the possibilities of cultural engagement and discipleship, overly optimistic about transformation of culture.
Indeed, right.
And I think this is large. So, for example, to bring it up to modern day, this is largely what motivates criticisms of someone like David Van Drunen about the Kuiperian tradition, or at least some version of the Kuiperian tradition. It's overly optimistic and triumphalist with respect to cultural engagement, things like that. So. You have church splits. I mean, in the Christian Reformed Church in North America,
The Protestant Reformed Church in 23.
Codifies common grace in the early 20th century as a formal teaching of the church, not at a confessional level, but as a kind of a denominational position. And you have disagreements from people like Herman Hoeksema and the Protestant Reform, and so you have church schisms and splits over this kind of a doctrine too. So I guess that's a kind of a, maybe going on too long, but there's a lot more to be said, and it's a living, controversial kind of a doctrine, I think, partly because it is so dynamic and inspiring, but also because with any true thing, there are dangers to overemphasis or to misinterpretation or misapplication.
Yeah. No, and that's why people need to read, and also there's a lot of misunderstandings where people might think that they know what Kuyper said, and this we study and do a lot of work in Cornelius Van Til, who's definitely engaging and dialoguing with Kuyper and Warfield, and many people would see that Van Til is something of kind of like a bridge between the two, at least with regards to common grace and apologetics. That's something for another conversation, but it's always significant and important to read the primary sources, and that's where there's great value in this 12-volume series on the collected works on public theology, that we can do just that. And so it's been quite instructive to have you teach us and to hear many of these things about Kuyper and Kuyper's life and what he was getting at with public theology specifically. I'm curious for folks who might want to follow up and have an introduction, not just to the theology and the history of Abraham Kuyper, but even more generally to the concerns that are raised or addressed by the Acton Institute and your own individual studies. How might people, where would you suggest that they begin if they want to cut their teeth on some of these things, or as even the website says in the Acton Institute regarding its university, explore the intersection between faith and free markets, but we could also say the intersection between faith and fill in the blank. Where would you suggest people start to begin? Where would they begin on this endeavor?
If you want to get into Kuyper himself, I would recommend, I mentioned the volume earlier, Wisdom and Wonder. That's those 10 chapters.
That's on Kindle too. It's easy to get, real easy to get.
Yeah, actually, so if you have Logos, which all of these 12 volumes are available on Logos, that's one of the free things they've made available. They've made available those
even better.
Wonder. They made available his sermon speech on the church as an institution and organism, and his two addresses at the Free University of Amsterdam on the pursuit of scholarship from a Christian perspective. Those are all free. If you've got Logos, you can go and find those and download them and read them right now. Those would be the places to start if you want kind of a brief, accessible introduction to Kuyper's primary sources himself. See the style of writing that he's got, and whether you'll see immediately there are places that you're going to be really inspired and places where you think, oh my gosh, he's so off base here. Right? It's inspiring in terms of your own thinking in any case. In terms of an introduction to Kuyper, there's a fine biography if you want to dig in more by James Bratt. That's the best biography in English. For the recent vintage. Richard Mao has a short and personal introduction to Kuyper. That's also worth engaging, I would say, as kind of secondary biographical type sources. I myself, if I can plug it, am working on a very brief companion to Kuyper's public theology that I hope will appear next year.
Wonderful.
Next year, coincidentally, will be the conclusion of the series. So there are three volumes that are yet to come out.
That's 2020 for people.
Will appear next year.
Right.
2020 is the centennial of Kuyper's death. He died in 1920, so there's a big anniversary there. There's going to be a Kuyper Congress that is happening in New York City in April and in Amsterdam. So the hope is that the series will appear next year. This little volume that I'm working on is hopefully going to appear next year if I can get it done. So that would be a place to start, too. If you're interested in Reformed theology and economics, the Acton Institute has published a primer on the intersection between Reformed theology and the questions of faith and work and economics and vocation. John Bolt, one of my seminary professors from Calvin Theological Seminary, who himself is a Kuyper and Bovink expert, wrote that for the Acton Institute. It's called Economic Shalom. I would recommend that. So those are some places to start. The series itself is available from the Acton Institute. It's available from the publisher at Lexham Press. They've done a fine job putting a nice website together, just abrahamkuyper.com. They can go to and find out more about all the 12 volumes.
And I encourage people also to take a look at
acton.org, A-C-T-O-N. There's a wealth of resources there, and there are always lecture series and conference series that are coming up. So when this comes out, I think some events will recently have just happened, but there's also some scheduled toward the end of January and on into February. There's an events calendar where you can find out information about those things. In addition to many other resources, such as the Acton Line podcast and those several blogs and other articles and a lot of other videos that are available on the website. So there's a wealth of resources there just to dip around. People can get a flavor or a taste of the resources available and see if they'd like to go further. So it's there's a lot. And check out Lexham and Lagos, and we'll have links all in the episode description to all of those resources. But thank you so much, Jordan, for taking the time today. We really appreciated speaking with you.
Well, Camden and Jim, it's been a great pleasure. I really appreciate it, and thanks for this opportunity and blessings on your work.
Yeah, well, thank you. You bet. And we encourage people to visit us online as well at reformedforum.org. And there you'll find out ways in which you can get in touch with us or find out what we have scheduled and the events coming forward and other episodes that are available on the subject. Again, that recent episode with Sean Rittenour was an interesting introduction to economics from a Christian perspective. And so you can dig in there as well into the archives. But I do want to thank everybody for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.